Right. yeah. Okay. Right. Okay then.
So,
Yeah.
if you go back to Claremont Road
Hmm.
and talk again about the art house, but like, because that was like partly the anti-row protesters and partly artists who lived in the area or working artists and that. Can you sort of just give me a sort of overview on who in the community went in that house over the time of the show and who did what?
I mean, it was organised by the artist. The original house, the notion of it, was organised by the artist. I mean, I was contacted by Tom Cousins, this muralist from Manchester, and then I talked to Christine Binney about it, and she thought it was a good idea, and so we went to the campaigners, the campaign office, and said, you know, could we have some materials? Would they be able to give us some materials to do the work? And so we got the materials from the campaign, and then people who were coming to the Claremont Road every day, say they were part of the community, young people who lived round and about, sort of Leytonstone, Wanstead, they would be in Claremont Road, and they took an interest in it, so they were actually what were enthusiastic to take part as well. And then there were sort of, I mean, it depends on the room, because I mean, Christine Binney did her own room. I did the outside bit, and my friend Claire, who'd become a protester, she helped me do that. Then there was Mary's contribution, which was in a couple of places. And then other people had taken part, say in the kitchen, children had taken part in that. So they were children who were, had really come in with interested people from the community, really. And they're children. So there was a lot of interest from the community and participation from the local community as well. There was one young woman whose name I can't remember, and I know that she was not a protester as such, but she would come to Claremont Road, and she did a lot of the painting. She was a really talented young person, and she did a lot of the painting of the front of the houses. So it was, you know, there was a lot of participation from all sorts of people. I mean, the protesters themselves, I don't think had that much input in it, but they did like it once it was up and running, because so many people came to visit it that they would then hold their meetings there sometimes, and they would be there campaigning really from the art house. So there were a lot of things actually going on in the art house for the length of time that it was there, and it did include sort of all, you know, the artists and the campaigners and various sort of people in the community as well. We couldn't all put in the same amount of time, you know. I mean, you know, we all had other things that we were doing. We weren't full-time protesters, so we weren't there for the. I wasn't there certainly for the whole of the time, the life of the art house. But I mean that has a legacy really, because there was somebody who became very involved in it. Called Neil, a young man called Neil, and he's been very instrumental in setting up and running the 491 gallery in Leytonstone.
So that's Neil Goodwin,
Yes, and he was very involved in the art house, and he was a protester.
and he did the film, didn't he, which included
Did he?
the art house.
Yes. He was very enthusiastic about it. I mean, he really, you know, he was very much part of the art house project, and but you know, that has then taken that sort of energy and created, helped create with others the 491 gallery. So he's been a bit of a main person there.
So what did Neil do in the art house
I
then?
don't know, I can't remember. I mean, he would have taken part in some of the construction of what, say, one room, which was more of a kind of a upstairs. There's no photographs of it, unfortunately, but it was very much a kind of a bits of junk from roads and things like that, and there are bits hanging from the ceiling, and you walked into it, and it was a bit of a sensory experience, because it was sort of had flashing lights and So there were elements where he would take part in that, and he would house sit. We all house sat for a bit. We all had, various people had keys, and we would sit in the house and you know, welcome people and talk about it. And he would be one of the people who would do that. So yeah.
So, was there any particular place that the art house idea came from? Because it makes me think of Judy Chicago's Woman House. From late 1960s to 70s.
Right.
Where women work with domestic objects to make a political point.
Things were so accelerated. Time was sort of, it was like sandwiched, it was compressed. I mean, people kind of acted more on impulse, really, than anything else, and things had to happen really fast. So even though we had meetings about how we wanted to make it, try and keep it positive, although there were elements of very obvious statements about how roads were sort of bad for our health and what have you. In our meetings, our initial meetings, we wanted to have the slant on some kind of energy, some sort of positive energy in the house, so that it wasn't all sort of doom and gloom, but it had, you know, quite a sort of an amusing take as well. There was a lovely little thing that I saw on the wall somewhere, which is just a little comment I saw, and it was someone had daubed on a wall, cars are crap, penguins are amazing. And so that was actually replicated in the art, in the kitchen downstairs, in the art, in the art house, because it was just a very childlike sort of simple I mean, it was nothing sort of mind shattering or anything like that, but it was very immediate, and the people responded very immediately to it. And and I mean, people who did care. I mean, we had sort of environmentalists sort of visiting the art house from other sites in the world, where there were, you know, really quite you know, again, environmentally sort of threatening sort of situations, sort of where dams were being built and where villages would be lost. And we had people coming over from those organisations, and they would show their films. I don't remember that. They might well have done. I saw those films at further down near Philibert Road, where they had the yurts for a while. They had a little camp there.
So they had film screenings going on as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when you was in the art house, did you ever meet a guy called Greg Barnett, a sociologist who wrote a paper by the title of the text you just quoted? Penguins are amazing.
Really?
So I wondered where he got why he chose that title.
And I don't know.
You've actually articulated why he chose that title.
I saw it daubed on a wall somewhere, and I just sort of brought it up there, because I just thought it was just such a simple statement, very sort of childlike kind of statement. With no kind of deep, in-depth arguments for or against, but patently, we've learned since that time that, you know, cars do add quite a lot to the polluting of our planet, and that penguins are indeed amazing. So, you know, it's really quite, you know. And I didn't know that. No, I don't think I've heard of him. Or if I have, I don't know his surname anyway. So really, his name, his text,
so he came has to he? The art house.
He must have. Had he picked up on that then? He picked. Mm. Did he?
So I don't know. Just a little bit more about that street and how. I don't know. Were there any artists at that time living down the street? I mean, Ian Bourne was living at the end.
Right.
The filmmaker, I don't know if you yes. know him.
I'm not aware of having met him. I know his name.
From Housewatch.
Yes. And what he was, what, in Claremont Road?
Mm.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, were there artists, do you know, that regularly went down? I mean, did you regularly go down there?
I did. Yes, I did. More or less on a daily basis, because if I could manage to, I'd either be involved in the art house, mostly involved in the art house, really, before it was demolished.
And then how long was the art house there for?
I can't remember. It was very, very short. It was, really, on the leaflet that was printed, it's got 13th of April to May, sometime depending on demolition. So, you know, it was there longer than we anticipated. I mean, it was there for a bit longer. There was the threat. It was from the 13th of April, and that had been 94. So it was on the cards that it was going to be demolished any time. So, you know, we went in, we made the decisions really quickly, we got the materials, we got people to come in and help and work and stuff. And then it was actually there for, you know, April, May. I mean, it must have been, it's got to have been about a month that it was there. I can't remember exactly, but it was a fair amount of time, longer than we actually anticipated, which is great.
So you was down there for a fair amount of time, so you would have got to know some of the anti-road protectors.
Well, I had a friend who lived down there, and who had became a protester. She had her car windows smashed in at 2 o'clock in the morning, and she was so shocked that she decided to be a protester after that. And really, I kind of went down there to see her, to see how she was doing. And to look after her a little bit as well, because, you know, she's very young, and she was going to be, fire and flame for it, and basically was climbing up on roofs and had her arm in a lock-in, I think. What's it called? Which is a long metal tube, and you hold on to a bit of metal at the bottom, and it's quite painful if you're prized off that. And so I was down there for the art house, and she helped me on my bit of artwork as well, but I was down there sort of making sure she was okay, really, through the protest.
Was she another Acme artist?
No, she wasn't an artist, but she was living down Claremont Road. She was very brave, I thought, because she was working as a TA in a school, some part time, but this decided her really to become a protester. And she was actually hauled off the roof at one stage quite violently, and it disappeared, and we didn't know where she was. And that was quite a worrying time. There were other friends there wondering how, you know, where she was, and she was actually arrested for a while. So it was sort of twofold, and then it was because of her that I actually got to know some of the protesters a little bit. Not a great deal. She got to know them more than I did, but I had a kind of a foot in the camp, as it were, because some people didn't really involve themselves with the protesters at all, and some of them, like my friend, who wasn't an artist, but she became a protester, and then people like Christine Binney, who seemed to sort of want to get involved in the protesting eventually, you know, and Christine was doing quite a lot of different types of work, but she was doing ceramics down at Dyer's Hall, mainly working on ceramics. So things sort of pull people in for various reasons, and sort of got involved to certain degrees, like Joe Rodriguez, for example, who brought his welding gear along and cut a car. It was a dumped car, and he sawed it into pieces and made it into sort of a sculpture statement, really. So there's various people who became involved in, you know, projects. And someone called Lisa Wooding actually moved in down to the bottom of Claremont Road for a bit. That wasn't where she had lived, but that she lived there for a bit. So, you know, it was sort of fairly individual, really. All our experiences were fairly individual. But what did link us, I suppose, with say the protesters and the artists and the rest of the community, was that none of us were in favour of a rather large, polluting bit of motorway coming through the community. I think that's what we're all in agreement with, really. Everyone. that we don't, you know, we didn't actually need, or this community didn't actually need a rather large road which would knock down quite so many houses just for the sake of building a road.
And you said before about when you was living at your house in Grove Green, the Acme House, some protesters asked you if you wanted to get your attic reinforced or something.
Well, no, they were going to squat my attic. They offered very kindly to squat my attic for me. And I did decline their offer, their kind offer, because I thought I'd then become a complete target, really. I didn't really want to be bulldozed out of my home, as some neighbours had been. I really couldn't face that. I wanted to leave with as much dignity as possible. So I did actually say no to that, no thanks. I mean, it would have been just like a magnet, really, for police to come and to get me out. And I didn't really want that. You know, I just wanted to try and maintain as much as possible a normal life, which is really difficult. But because we were all, if anything was happening, for instance, at say Stratford Town Hall, there was an appeal meeting. There was a meeting, and there had been several, but that was the only one I went to, and it was a farce. So everybody was sort of on the phone and sort of talking about what could be brought to the meeting. You know, the artists were talking amongst themselves, and we all went. Sheila Whittaker went, I went, Joe Rodriguez, we all went, and the protesters, they went. And people who'd got together quite a large amount of information, but none of that was heard. It was a complete farce, and everybody knew it was a farce from beginning to end. And so the people who were meant to be, you know, not involved with one side or another, they went out to the same door as the Department of Transport people, and it was obvious, you know. And there was no time for anybody else to put forward all this information. So sort of whilst we were trying to live life in a normal way, it patently wasn't. Because you were involved in everything that you know you thought might help somehow, and there was this kind of rather strange hope that maybe they might sort of say, well, no, we'll shelve this, but it didn't happen. But there was right to the end, people were still hoping that might happen.
So going back to the protesters who wanted to squat your attic.
Yes.
Was the plan to maybe squat the attics in Grove Green Road so that there could be a final protest on the roof as there was in Claremont Road?
I imagine so, but there wasn't much left. I was just about the only one left by then. You know, everything, but I mean, my cottage was standing on its own. And the house that had been sort of built onto my cottage had been knocked down, that had been demolished. It was semi-detached from the other side, and that had been demolished. So there was nothing around. So it would have just been that. It would have been the last statement. I mean, what they liked about it was the fact that this was the first. I had been told by my neighbours who'd moved that it was the first cottage to have been built there. And so that's what the protesters liked about that, that they thought that, you know, the first house, last house, that concept, they really liked that. And so did I. But I did think about it, but I thought, no, I really don't, I don't actually want to be physically hauled out. It's just not in my nature to be that sort of, you know, out in front in a protest. You know, I felt that what I had been doing. I was on the telephone tree, for example, and if people came from wherever, I'd put them up at night and I'd feed them and stuff like that. So, you know, before it really got bad, you know, I mean, there were people, you know, coming and sleeping.
Can you explain what the telephone tree is?
Where, you know, if somebody phoned you up and said that this was happening or that was happening, say, for instance, if when the tree in Wanstead was finally going to be destroyed, then if somebody phoned you up, you'd phone somebody else up, and you know, you might have a list of people that you'd ring, and then they'd bring other people so that people could go down and see if they could do anything to stop it being demolished. So that's what the telephone tree was like.
Basically a community
network. Yes. And we had all sorts of people on that. I mean, the what was her name? The woman who was the lollipop lady, the Welsh lollipop lady. She was very vocal. I mean, she kind of lost her job, but then I think it got reinstated. You know, and I mean, she was the local, very much a local person, and she was there last year, and you know, very fired up about it, and a lot of local young people as well. So it was a big kind of, it wasn't just mobilising protesters, it was like a telephone tree for everyone in the area to go along and support that tree in that instance. Yes. And I think I was there, not when it was being taken down, I wasn't there then, but I was talking to people shortly afterwards, and they had been talking to the tree surgeon, who was part of the group of people who were sawing the tree, the oldest tree down, and basically they said that it cost more to cut it down like that than it would have done to have actually dug it up and moved it, which is quite interesting. So they need not have done what they need not have been quite so destructive. They could have thought about the tree and actually moved that tree further on into the green, because it does look a bit empty. It looks empty. It doesn't look, you know, nobody's done any real planting, and that literally, I was quite surprised that apparently that is the case, that it could have been dug up cheaper than having people saw its limbs off.
Yeah.
So that's really quite interesting.
Very ironic. So, one, you know, sort of like, I just want to kind of get a sense of the kind of mingling the different communities here. Because I do know that when the early times when artists moved into the area, it took a while to get to know the more long-term local residents, and then everyone started to mingle. Was it like that with the protesters? Because the protesters, the road protesters who came from Twyford, they were here for about maybe 2 or 3 years.
Were they?
I don't know, I'm asking.
Right, I don't know, as long as that, I don't know. Not sure.
Have you got any?
No.
The protests sort of around here ended in 94.
But yes.
But then it continued up at
Green
Mound, whatever.
Yeah.
But have you got any sense of when they actually started moving in? Was it like 92 or 93?
I just don't know, I can't remember really. It wasn't 92, I don't think, because there were lots of artists there still, because I mean we still thought that we were all going to be all right, and it was only, I think it was when part of Dyer's Hall was demolished, they went in very quickly, and that's where Joe had lived, Joe Rodriguez, and Mark
Soudan,
and that was a great shock. That those few houses, they'd whizzed in and demolished those already, and that it then became a kind of reality. I mean, there'd always been that protest, but with the residents more so. So it kind of escalated. There must have been something which triggered it off, and I don't remember what it is, because then we started getting an influx of people.
Because you'd been involved in the public inquiries, hadn't you, just before?
Yeah, but, well, with the public inquiry, I went to one public inquiry, yes. And we all kind of, they had the, you know, proposed road and what that was going to be looking like, and that was across the road here, not so far from here. And we all did kind of have a look at that. And we did all, you know, I mean, there weren't protesters then. And we, you know, a lot of us were, you know, we were very aware that initially when there had been the first road proposal, which was in the 1920s, and it was meant to be, it was not going to be a major road with loads and loads of traffic on it, because hardly anybody had cars in those days. So it was really just, it was for residents, but that was part of the argument. Well, how is this going to be for residents? You know, where does that fit in? It's going through the area. It's not really part, you know, for the residents, really. And so the whole kind of nature of it had changed over the years. So we were really against that. But I can't remember when the protesters started coming in. I think there was a much more of an influx. There was an office set up before Claremont Road had the cars windows bashed in. There was a little bit, there was an office already, sort of M11 Link Road campaign. Because there'd always been a campaign though. But it kind of escalated a bit more and more money was put into it from various sources.
When you say there was an office, do you mean in Claremont Road or in Wanstead, a campaign office?
No, there was M11 Link Road. In Claremont Road, once the windows had been smashed in of the cars, one of the residents there, who is not an artist, I think he was a scientist, young scientist, he had part of his home set up as an office for a bit before it moved to the Arches down the road.
Okay, so when you say down the road...
It was underneath the Arches in Grove Green Road, where the railway goes across, near the Northcote, the other pub, it's near there.
Near the Heathcote,
it's near there.
So that was before the anti-road protesters arrived, or the same time?
That was about the same time. People started to arrive after that because people heard about that event, and people, I mean, there were... What beginning events? To be protesters, yeah. But not that much, you know. It was just a normal street before that. I mean, you didn't really see an awful lot of protesters before that sort of event. That really escalated it.
So what event are we talking about?
When it became, no, you know, the threat, when Claremont Road was, you know, threatened with demolition very, very soon, that's what mobilised, really, protesters coming in, young protesters from all over. You know, because before that it was just a fairly quiet road. I remember going down there and there'd be sort of, you know, seeing my friend where she lived in Claremont Road. There was nothing going on, really. It was just a normal road, you know.
So you're basically saying that the Department of Transport started demolishing houses down Claremont Road and that motivated people?
No. When the action of cars' windows were smashed, that sort of made people think about what was actually happening, you know, that there was something rather, you know, not good, wasn't happening, and that did, it must have, you know, people heard about it all over the place. Tom Cousins, he heard about it and wanted to come down, and that's when it really escalated. It wasn't that long, really. It was sort of 93, 94, it wasn't 2 years. I don't think it was two. It wasn't 2 years. It all happened. It was a very short time scale, really.
So almost in the last year, really.
Yes, yes. Because people came from all over then. I remember being in 181, and I was on my own, and it was quite nerve-wracking. And you'd hear a sound, and I'd sort of look out of the window at night, and you know, someone had sort of managed to get round and had fallen asleep in the garden and things like that. It was a bit nerve-wracking. And then another time there was the corrugated iron which had been put down one side, there was sounds of that being pulled off, and I went out and there were these young protesters. And I said, look, I said, you know, there's a light on in there, you know, I'm obviously still here. I said, that's here to protect me as much as anything at the moment, because I'm literally on my own. They were a bit mouthy, these young ones. And then there was somebody else, he apologised and said they'd put it back. And I invited him in for a cup of tea, and he'd come from another area up north somewhere, from a village where he came from, and they'd put a very large road which had totally decimated this village. And he'd been known for being able to climb right to the top of these huge cranes called cherry pickers, and he'd done it up there. And he'd come down for the protest to do it here as well. And I'm pretty sure he was the one who was up on a massive crane just down the road from me a bit, and then they'd lock themselves onto that, and it'd take a long time for them, for the demolition people to come along and get an equally tall crane to try and prise them off. So it was, so it, you know.
So the chromatodyne that they were taking, was that in your front garden?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So what was he planning to use it for?
Oh, barricading something or other. Yes.
So he was on the ready.
Well, but he was fine. He was lovely. You know, when he actually came in. I mean, a lot of the protesters were young, you know, students, and you know they'd be you know, often they'd be under the age of 20. So they're all fire and flame, but they weren't, you know, they didn't actually spot the fact that there happened to be a light on, and you know, still had a roof on, and you know, I lived there, you know. But you know, ultimately he was a decent enough chap, and had a cup of tea and waved him on his way, you know. And they put my protective shield back again. Very sweet, really. Really quite sweet. Mm. Yeah. But it was, you know, really wasn't that. It was, you know. And then, you know, as there was more publicity, and there'd be they'd have street parties in Claremont Road, and my friend Claire would be going out doing flyers for the Claremont Road street parties. They had a few of those. They were very successful. I had some good groups down there. You know, and people came from all over, and so it kind of escalated from there, really.
So, down that street as well, you mentioned, did the netting presumably went up quite late?
Mm.
But were there those sculptures down the street when they had the street parties?
There were more and more sculptures. They'd appear sort of, you know, kind of on a daily basis. They'd be made, yes, and they'd be made by the protesters, the ones in the street generally. It was sort of started off, I think it was started off by the art house,
in a way.
I think it had, there was an element of that. I mean, I don't know, that's just sort of anecdotal, but I do get the feeling that was the case, because Tom Cousins worked with a few young people, and they decorated the whole of the row of houses with daisies and things like that, and then people started sort of hammering things together and making sort of sculptures and seating arrangements and things like that, and tree houses, and so it did escalate.
So the daisies came about out of a workshop, basically, from the art
house. Yes, yes.
So what was the order of things? Did the art house then clearly come first?
Yes, I think so. I think so, yeah. And then, you know, there was another dumped car, and, you know, other people were beginning to work on that. I don't know who did that. There's someone's got a fantastic photograph of that. I haven't, of the car with lots of grass inside it. That was very effective, and all over it. It's very effective.
And do you know who did that car?
No. I don't know who did that one.
Do you think it might have been the woman from the art house who did the shoes with the grass?
I would have known if it was Mary. I don't think it was Mary, no. Mm. No, but because they were working on other projects as well, sort of, you know, sort of Wiltshire, down in Wiltshire, Moreton Meadows and things, so I don't think, I would have known if it had been her. No, I don't know who did that, but yeah. But, you know, it became quite a sort of a creative thing, and people would get hold of different stuff, and a flatbed lorry, so they could have the jazz group on the flatbed lorry on a Sunday afternoon, and it was very lively down there, very lively. And I mean, as I said before, we'd all, you know, we would go down there on the Sunday afternoon and spend a bit of time down there, because it was quite pleasant.
So like on a Sunday, that's when you'd have all the jazz and everything.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. So that was nice. But you know, there were other elements which weren't quite so nice.
like?
Well, I think I've mentioned the one who was on the who decided that Burning Spear was the only music that anybody wanted to hear day or night, in fact all night generally, from the top of a pole at loud volume, and it drove everyone absolutely mad, including my friend who was a protester, but it, you know, who was actually sleeping in Claremont Road. It drove everyone absolutely potty, but he managed to climb up a very tall pole and put these speakers at the top somehow, and so we got Burning Spear day and night. So I'm not sure quite how many people that, you know, really, I mean, you know, really enjoyed that, really.
So by this time, were like a lot of local residents in Claremont Road gone, or what was the kind of?
I mean, some had gone, but there were still a few who were there. I mean, this young scientist, he was still there. Dolly was still there. Somebody who was a graphic designer, she was still there. You know, they were living there. And, you know, living and working, or trying to.
Mm.
Yeah, there were still a few people that who still lived in their own homes. But, it gradually got more complicated, and I know this graphic designer had to move out in the end, and was found another Acme house in Wanstead.
So, what do you mean by it got complicated?
It was very noisy. It was very noisy day and night, and some of the protesters, not all, but some of them. And it did really attract some of the local drinkers.
Okay.
So they would be there sort of all day and all night, sort of drinking away. And it was noisy. So, I mean, if you were trying to sort of do some work, you know, do your own work, it would be quite impossible by the time everybody was that attracted to the place. There was too much going on in the end. And, you know, people just couldn't get any sleep.
Oh.
So, you know, you did have to think about that and move on, really. Not that this, I know, I can't remember her name, but not that this, she wanted to move on, really, because she was very helpful to Dolly. She managed to find her somewhere after they dragged Dolly out, or didn't drag her out, but she had to leave. Can't remember her name.
Do you mean your friend who was the protester?
No, it wasn't her. God, I can't remember her name. She was she looked after her, after Dolly. She was really good to Dolly, and she was the one, not just her, there were other people.
Mm.
I think Neil was very good. And, I mean, Dolly did enjoy that, but as it got more tricky, because, you know, there were confrontations, you know, there were lots of security guards around. It was obvious that, you know, Dolly was going to have to leave. And I can't remember this woman's name, but she made sure that Dolly was sort of actually in a place where she was relatively okay. I mean, she didn't even have electricity, I don't think, in that house. You know, and it was really, you know, wherever she was going to go at the age of 92 or 93 was not going to be easy for her. And that was something else which actually was highlighted by a lot of people, was that was it so imperative to do that before, you know, Dolly had lived her life and, you know, peacefully? You know, couldn't they have waited a couple more years, because she wasn't going to last much more anyway? Couldn't they have just let her be in the home that she was in for the whole of her life? So, you know, it did highlight some callousness, you know, and just sort of bombastic behaviour on the part of, well, our beloved government and the DOT and Adal, really. But, you know, was it really necessary to do that?
And, I mean, I got the impression that Dolly was quite happy there. She seemed quite well looked after.
Yes, she was. She was very well looked after. She loved all the attention from the young men. Absolutely loved it. and said so. I mean, there was a radio, the Radio 4 short interview with her. Very, very well spoken, very erudite, you know, had all her marbles. And yes, absolutely loved all that. And they did her shopping for her and all sorts of things. No, there were elements, you know, but it just got more difficult for her to stay. I mean, you know, there was a lot of pressure, put more and more pressure was put on to get people out. I mean...
So you're talking about the duct department.
Oh, yes. You know, I mean, no, she loved the... and there'll be photographs somewhere, I mean, of her leaning on her front gate, you know, with Keith, I think it was. Her long blonde curly hair, and you know, absolutely lapping it up, this sort of, you know, the attention from these rather nice young men. I mean, yes, bring it on. She was great. No, it wasn't
so, I think she was fine. You know the Dolly Tower that was built?
No.
Oh, the scaffolding. Was that when Dolly was still there?
Oh, I don't think so. I'm not sure. I mean, I really couldn't. I couldn't actually say for sure. I don't know. Because it got really quite tense and quite violent towards the end. I mean, if you've seen the films, you've seen how the riot police have pulled people off roofs and you know, really very, very roughly, and where people have been really sort of quite badly injured. So, I mean, Dolly was not there then at the last knockings. I mean, she was there for, you know, as long as she could be. But they were determined to get people out and to demolish those buildings, and so they that's what they did.
So were there quite a lot of rooftop protests?
Yes. Oh yes.
Because you kind of sort of get the impression that all happened at the end, but.
Well, I mean, in that photograph with the art house, before the art house was demolished, I mean, that's a rooftop protest there.
Mm.
So that, you know, that was quite early on. I mean, the police presence is there, but it's not as massive as it was. I mean, you know, you've got a few security guards there, but I mean, you know, I mean, when this lot was demolished, there was a section demolished, then there were lots and lots of security guards there all the time. And then there were more rooftop.
So the security guards would basically live in the street. Did they have houses?
I've no idea where they lived. I don't know where they lived. I mean, they were on their watch or whatever. I don't know where they went after that. I've no idea, but they were there for, you know, great lengths of time, really hours and hours, and just sort of lots of them.
Changing shift?
Yes, they'll be changing shifts, but there were masses of them towards the end. I mean, this is nothing. You know, there were loads and loads of them.
So, was you here when there was that final protest?
What, at Claremont Road? I was about to go to work, I think, and where I live now, I could just sort of from the front see where my friend had barricaded herself in to one house with a friend of hers, and I'd come down the road. I might have said that yesterday. I came down the road with my friend Jenny and her baby. And we just wanted to see what was going on, and just before I bicycled off to go to work in the afternoon, and it was a really big manoeuvre. I mean, there were police vans which were arriving from every which way, very suddenly, and there were loads of them. And as we were coming down the road, it was just a bit. It was quite overwhelming, and I mean, one policeman did actually say to Jenny, you know, sort of, you know, to be careful with her baby and what have you. So I didn't sort of see the absolute last knockings, but I just saw when things were beginning. It was just the beginning of the end, really. And it's strange that where I'm living now, we just sheltered inside the front gate. Jenny and her baby and myself, we just sort of sort of looked round the wall to see what was, if we could see what was happening, and there were lines and lines of police and things, and I just thought about what might be happening to my friend, and but I had to go to work, and so that was that. I mean, I sort of, you know, heard about it, obviously.
So you mentioned the house that you lived in was the last house there and the first house built.
Yes, yes, yes.
When they demolished
Grove Cottage, yep.
What, can you remember what the area looked like while it was being, you know, during that time? Like, when your house was standing on its own, what did Dyer's Hall Road look like? What did Philibrook Road look like? What did Colville Road?
It was really difficult because everything was flattened and there were just piles and piles of rubble. When I looked out of my kitchen window, there was just a massive pile of rubble, you know, huge pile of rubble. And sort of, it just looked totally desolate, really. It's just, you know, things were not always knocked down to the ground, things, but, you know, that, so things looked really quite sad, and, you know, it was desolate, the area was desolate, and there were just rats everywhere, and the sort of a cat came to me, actually, that's him up there. Mm-hmm. And he'd be seen on the top, I think he'd been left by people, because people were scared, or or whatever, and some people just would leave in the middle of the night, even people I knew, and, you know, there's, oh no, they've gone, you know, and you'd seen them not long before, but they just disappeared, they couldn't take it. It was really, it got quite tough, really, and but that's basically what you saw.
So you're talking about all this rubble around. Mm-hmm. So when they were demolishing the houses, didn't they put like hoardings up?
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah. Yes, they did. But from my house, I could see the rubble because I was inside my house. Because they put tin up by the side and the front and along, but then I was in my house and I could see all the rubble.
So probably by that time, a lot of artists had gone.
Yeah. Yeah, they'd gone by then.
Do you know, can you remember the order of things in which things were demolished?
Not really. There's bits and pieces. There were squatters in the house next to me. And once they'd got them out, because there was a massive, that went through the courts and everything. Once they'd got them out, it was taken over as a rave. There was a rave house next to it. And then when they finally got the squatters out, they demolished that bit. So that went quite quickly. And the protesters were around at that time. because there was talk of squatting this fantastic cherry tree, very ancient cherry tree, in the next door neighbour's garden. But they pulled that up. I came back home from work once and I looked out in the garden. I thought, what's wrong? And noticed that the tree had just been holed over. It was an amazing tree. It was fantastic. The cherries on it were still really sweet. They were beautiful, but there was hardly any of it left. It was sort of it was just a ring of bark, and it was hollow inside, which was amazing. But the cherries were fantastic. But it was just such a shock to see that just pulled over, because they didn't want protesters to squat in that tree, so. That's why they did that. So it was bit by bit. It was kind of piecemeal. And once they'd gone, they demolished that. they started demolishing in Grovebrain Road a couple of houses down from my other neighbours and myself. So they were there for quite a bit longer, my other neighbours. Because they were offered a pittance for their home, you know, and all the time they'd lived in their home.
And were they homeowners?
They both worked and they're both homeowners. And, you know, that's something that doesn't work very well in this country and is an absolute disgrace, is that once they want to put a road through or whatever, your property's worth nothing. If you're in France, however, you're given more than the value of your property. to, you know, so it doesn't feel quite as bad a blow. But over here, they know they've got you by the short and curlies, and basically they know you can't sell on, and they offer you a laughably small amount. Now, that's another reason why my neighbours were just so upset by it, or just another, you know, reason, another nail in the coffin, really. Very, very upset. It just makes people feel so abused, you know, that they've worked hard all their lives, you know, but they needed to both of them work. But they'd done wonders with their house and their garden, and the most beautiful garden. And it was the love of Dave's life, you know, and he, I don't know if I mentioned it, but he was born in that house, and he was in his 50s, and it was his father's house. So it's really, really sad. And then on top of that, they're offered a measly amount of money to move. You know, it's really quite sick in this country. You know, I was sent through, well after that, from estate agents, actually, things that to say that in France, that's why I know, saying that in France, you're right, you know, the government aren't as abusive as that. They actually do realise what the terrible thing it is for the people who own the homeowners, and they make it worth their while. They give them more than the value of their house. So, you know.
And do you remember any evictions?
Any evictions? Well, the only eviction I sort of really know about is apart from obviously the various protesters, you know, hearing about it, not actually being on site, but was the composer. What was his name? The Mary, Graham Miller and Mary, and their son, their autistic son, and he was six then. And that was an appalling eviction, really, because, you know, there isn't supposed to be anything illegal about feeding a protester or whatever, or looking after a protester, but that's the only thing we can think of as to why they came in with the bailiffs, because they'd already organised somewhere to go and live, and another Acme property through Acme. Acme had helped find them somewhere else. And they came bursting in at round about 7 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And it was shocking how quickly that house was demolished.
So you're basically saying that Graham and his wife had a protester living in that house?
Well, they wasn't living. I think they might have even just had someone stay one night. And we can't think of any other reason as to why they would be acting such a way, because it's not actually illegal to, you know, say you sort of give a protester a cup of tea. I mean, they were right near the site. So I can't quite work out quite what it was, but it seems that they didn't particularly like that aspect of it anyway, because it was a bit of a...
You're talking as if Graham watched, because you mentioned the
Graham did watch
with the cameras, the telescopic cameras photographing
you. Yes, yes, yes.
So is that what you...
Oh, no, well, Graham would take photographs of them. And they didn't like that, because none of us liked having photographs taken of us. I mean, you know, that was a total invasion of privacy. They didn't know who the hell we were. Graham did react, and he started taking photographs out of his window and filming. And he did have a policeman knocking on his door saying, "What are you doing?" And he told him, "I mean, I'm doing some filming of my own." So I think they didn't like that. so it might well have been to do with that, but it was just absolutely appalling. I mean, they were acting as though he was a terrorist or something, you know. I mean, they knocked on my door, or the police knocked on my door. I mean, I had somebody in a sort of a peaked, you know, sort of more of a higher up policeman knocking on my door, and he said, "Can I come out?" And I wasn't even dressed, and I said, "Well, I can't really come out." I said, you know. There was somebody across the road, as a mutual friend, or as a friend of Mary and Graham, waving at me from across the road. And I said, "Well, I can't come out, obviously, you know. Can he come across the road to me?" And he said, "No, he can't do that."
Oh, so you meant, could Graham come?
No, it wasn't Graham, it's a friend of Graham's. And he was kind of waving at me and gesticulating, and this policeman would not let him come over to my front door.
So basically, this friend of yours wanted to visit you.
He was a friend of Mary and Graham.
Was checking out the situation.
No, he wasn't checking out. He came, knocked on my door to say that this person wanted to speak to me, right, and said, can I come out and speak to him out of my home? And I said, well, I can't come out of my home. I'm not dressed. I was in my pyjamas. And I said, you know, why can't he come over and talk to me? And the policeman wouldn't allow him to. He was a friend of Mary and Graham's. Mm. So, and really, basically, what it was is that Mary and Graham weren't allowed to come and visit me. They weren't allowed to come and tell me anything. They wanted to let me know what was going on, and also look after a few things for them, plants and things like that for them. Because they were given no notice, you know, they were in there with a battering ram and they it was horrifying how quickly they demolished that house. It was just unbelievable. But I mean, I was able to go out, but I wasn't allowed to go up to Mary and Graham's, and they weren't allowed to come down to me. It was just ridiculous. I mean, it was absurd.
So basically, it was cordoned off, even though there might not have been.
Right, so. Yeah, but I mean, I wasn't. I mean, you know, it was ludicrous. I mean, it was as though we were IRA terrorists or something, rather than sort of Acme artists, you know. Who... It's mad. I mean, you know, okay, Graham did play Grass Houses, which is something he composed, and he did play that quite loudly at times. And maybe the police didn't like that either, but, you know. But, you know, you did find yourself getting quite angry about the things that were done because they didn't know you from Adam. They didn't know that you were one of the protesters or not, and they didn't bother checking out whether you were or not. And so they were treating you like crap, basically. Mm. And God knows what that's done to that child, you know, because, I mean, he is autistic, you know, but who knows what that kind of, what effect that's actually had on that 6-year-old. Was just sitting there having breakfast. And, it wasn't as if that these people weren't going to go. They were going to go. They were going to go to a place in Hackney. There was absolutely no need for this at all. None at all. I mean, they took ages to get over that. They took such a long time to get over that. They couldn't, once they'd left, I mean, we saw a lot of each other, but once they left, they didn't want any connection with this area whatsoever. I mean, I did see them when I went down to the, you know, just when Graham was doing his audio piece down the Greymoan roundabout, and it was lovely to see him. But they couldn't come back to this area. It was just too deeply shocking for them, and they just wanted to cut off completely from everything. It had a really, really sort of bad effect on a lot of people like that. Because it was handled so badly. Yeah. It was handled so badly.
I mean... What happened to Graham's stuff? I mean, did they come
don't know.
And just chuck the stuff
oh,
out?
Oh,
the what was going on?
Well, I mean, I don't know what happened. I know that Roger Kite appeared quite quickly on the scene, and I mean, I was really upset about it all. And Roger came down to me, and I did say to Roger, I said, you know, if I actually boil an egg for a protester, does that mean I'm likely to have this happen to me? You know. It could, and Roger couldn't say one way or another whether or not it could. But, I mean, he was there to help Mary and Graham. I mean, they must have been allowed to make a few phone calls and stuff to get vans organised to take stuff, you know. But nevertheless, it still happened in just a few hours, and that house was razed to the ground. It's deeply shocking. And, you know, there was no discrimination between...
I mean, did Graham get time to get his stuff out?
I think he must have done. But I mean, but they were in the house then. That was it, and they had to go. They had to go. They must have done. I mean, I think Acme organised it. I'm not sure, but I think Acme organised transport and stuff. But no, I mean,
it sounds like Acme were really supportive. Actually.
They were very good. They were great. Roger was great. I mean, I was in tears, and I mean, Roger just put an arm around my shoulder. You know, because you know it was deeply shocking. What had happened, deeply, deeply shocking, because they'd tried so hard, Acme, to maintain a trusting relationship with the DOT. And in the main, that had worked. But once they'd drafted in loads and loads of police from all around the country, all that went by the board, and there was just paranoia reigned, really, wholesale paranoia. I mean, they did the head of the police who came down, he had been in Ireland. That's where he'd come from. So that's who they got in, you know, someone who was dealing with terrorism, you know, and people who were working for a cause and who would shoot one another, not artists who, you know, whose weapons might be a paintbrush or an, you know, or an audio tape or something.
Like this was going on, there must have still been some local residents. Yeah. Like, who was hanging out?
Well, I mean, obviously, people across the road, everywhere else, down Grove Green Road, I mean, they were having problems as well. Because they might want to go to the local pub, to the Northcote, and they'd have these police barriers saying, who are you, blah, 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 I live there, and they were having to try and prove it. And
so, literally, they were cordoning off parts of
the area. Yes. There was a cordon outside my house after Mary and Graham's house had been knocked down. Big metal barriers. And I was, you know, there with my bike trying to get to work. And I was furious because, I mean, nobody helped me move one of these metal barriers. They just ignored me. And I lived there. I was on my way to work. I wasn't on my way to protest. I was on my way to work for the local borough.
Even day-to-day things mm-hmm. became quite difficult.
Very difficult. Extremely difficult. So, you know, no, dreadful. And I mean, you know, I sort of before I closed my curtains, you know, with all the police, there was a line right outside my bedroom window, you know, and they were all kind of looking up, you know, it was horrible. And you felt as though you were like a goldfish in a bowl. It's just awful. No, it was not good, because they questioned who I was. And I said, well, I live there. There's nothing else. That is where I live, you know.
I mean, before, you mentioned a guy who was very active in the campaign. Mm. I don't know if it was a long-term resident who got very ill.
Oh, he was a resident before.
And he was involved in the No M11 campaign.
Yes, he was. Old Mick was, yes. He became very involved in it, and it seemed, I mean, he took it on full scale, really, as a real cause for him, and, you know, became a very committed protester and barricaded himself into the house where he lived, which is just sort of Claremont Road. He just went, on the left. It was just on the corner. And he barricaded himself in there, and he took it to those extremes.
So was that Mick Roberts?
I think it must have been.
Do you remember his scaffolding on his roof?
Yes, I do.
So it's the same.
Yes. Yeah.
So I mean, he developed cancer, didn't he?
Yes.
So he believes that was caused by the stress?
I don't honestly know. I mean, that's not what I've heard. I haven't heard that he blamed that on that particularly. But, he was a bit of a character in the area before he became a campaigner.
Oh.
I mean, he wasn't like a 9-to-5... type of person going into work and stuff like that. He was a little bit of a tatter, you know, sort of picking up bits and pieces and making money like that. And, you know, I mean, Angie used to work with him, so he wasn't exactly a drifter, but he wasn't, you know, your average kind of, oh, it's 6 o'clock in the morning, must get up, I work in the city type. He was a bit of an outsider anyway, but it seemed to all kind of really pull things together for him when this protest happened, and it became a very firm belief for him, and he stuck with it through thick and thin.
Oh, so he was quite strong about his motives. And
he became like that. Yes, he did.